It's 8:10. Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. It's the KPCW Local News Hour. Well, as law enforcement continues with its investigation of an incident of a student loading an airsoft gun into a backpack and posting it on social media last night, Park City School Board members yesterday discussed school safety. In the studio with a recap of that, I have School Board member Andrew Kaplan along with Business Administrator Todd Halbert. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie. Good morning.
Andrew, can we just start with you? I mean, do we have any more information into the student and the investigation that's ongoing?
No, it's a police matter now. There was a statement released by the school district this morning around 6:30, giving some details. A student placed a picture on Snapchat and sent it around to other students of them placing an airsoft handgun into a backpack. And fortunately, what's supposed to happened, which is that concerned students contacted authorities and the police was dispatched to the student's home where they located the airsoft gun. And they're doing a full investigation. The student will be home today, and there's no additional threat.
Yeah. Is the student facing expulsion? I mean, is this that kind of...
We'll see. I mean, it's a disciplinary matter left to the district. I think we take these things very, very seriously. And, you know, as you just mentioned, safety is paramount to us at the district. So we'll be looking at it pending the investigation.
Yeah. And certainly, I mean, kids, they think this might be funny, you know, playing a joke, but we can't joke about this stuff anymore.
No,
this
is
the lesson.
It's horrible, you know, that this is what it's come to. You know, we are very fortunate in our district. We have a safe district. We have, you know, we have schools where, you know, you don't have three metal detectors to walk through. We don't have, you know, it doesn't look like a prison. It looks like a school. And that's one of the reasons we all live here in this community. But that said, we need to be realistic about the threats that are out there. And, you know, as you mentioned, that's why we're looking at a substantial investment into improving the safety at our schools, which includes everything from fencing the perimeters to fixing the front offices so that we can really control who comes in and out to, you know, self-locking doors and all of that. And it's a considerable investment that we're looking at making, but it's worthwhile. I mean, you can't put a price on kids' lives.
Yeah. We've talked about these before and nothing was ever done. Why was that? Just no money or?
It predated me on the board, so I can't give you exact details. I think there was some controversy about, you know, back at the time where they looked at it about some of the fencing and some of the perimeter activities and then, you know, some of the other issues. But we've prioritized it as a board and as an administration, and it's going to happen this year.
Yeah, and I was going to note that fencing has been on the docket before. There were a lot of complaints by neighbors. The project then pulled back. So, I mean, the board's just moving forward with it in spite of
the complaints. I think last time it was a question, do we need to do this? And obviously, if you go to the community and you say, do we need to do this, and it impacts you know, people's views or backyards or access to play areas, obviously the answer would be no. Of course we don't want to do it. But I think we're at a point now where and you know, today or yesterday's, you know, incident is a reminder that unfortunately we live in a day and age where we have to be very careful with our schools and with our children. And there's nothing more important than our children's lives and their safety. And so we are going to do this. And fortunately, you know, due to good you know, fiscal discipline on the part of Todd and the administration, we have the ability to pay for this, and we're going to.
And the cost at about $3 million, Todd, so where does that money come from? Just the capital?
So at this point, it'll have to come from the reserves in the capital fund because we're past tax discussions and things like that. So we'll make it work.
Yeah. When we talk about what's in that capital fund, I mean, we had hoped that we were going to use some of that for a new school and other things.
Sure. And so these are just the different exercises to go through to make sure that we have money available. When important situations arise, we'll reprioritize those dollars to those purposes. That's the benefit of having that kind of a capital reserve available.
Yeah. What's in that reserve at this point?
So it's about $21 million. We're working with the external auditors. We'll have that closed out at the end of the month, and I'll have a solid number for you.
All right. And so let's talk a little bit more about some of those measures. I mean, we're talking about remodeling all of the entrances. I mean, as anybody knows who goes to the school, you really can just walk through, even though there's big signs that say, please check in. But this will make it so that you must check in?
Correct. You'll have to go through the office. There'll be an electronic sign-in, so we have a record of who came in, not just the pieces of paper that you write your name in on now, optionally, but there'll be electronic records of who came in at what time, and you know, and it will help us control who's coming in and out of our schools, both adults and students.
And then the fencing, are we talking about all of the elementary schools?
That's correct. We have fencing at Jeremy already. The real additions would be McPullen and Parley's, and we're gonna work with families and the communities around those schools to go over a couple options as to what they can look like and how they'll work. We recognize that obviously those are shared use fields where, you know, the community uses them, and so our interest is not to shut those off from people using them. It's quite the opposite. You know, the schools belong to the communities, as do the playgrounds, but we just want to make sure that while the kids are there, from a safety perspective, people can't walk in, moose can't walk in. You know, we have probably once a year we have moose on the playground and have to do lockdowns at our school. We have, you know, there's issues where, you know, non-custodial parents could come and pick their kids up on the playground. There's all kinds of different things that would be mitigated with some fencing.
Well, you mentioned that, but at Trailside we had nearly an elk stampede.
Exactly.
Last year.
I mean, these are the high quality problems of living in Park City. Obviously, we love to see our wildlife, but you know, our student safety is paramount, so we need to make sure that we're keeping everyone safe.
You didn't mention Trailside, but that will be included in terms of the fencing?
Yes.
Yeah. And also identification. I know the district administration wears administration, but now this will all be required by students and faculty?
That's correct. You know, we're starting the process now. It's something that would be implemented hopefully next year. You know, the student, it could be a blessing in that, you know, it'll help people link their lunch cards to their IDs and things like that, link their bus passes. So, you know, students are using IDs and different things in different ways already, and we're really just looking at streamlining that. And again, you know, allowing the building's access to students and people who really should be there only.
All right. And then there will also be within the office basically just the one button that would, what, lock doors and send an alarm to...
Exactly. So there's a couple things. You know, we would have notification if doors are left propped open that would immediately send a response to the front office, as well as a lockdown button, so that if police call and say there's an incident, or if, you know, something is noticed by school staff, all doors can be locked immediately for a lockdown procedure.
So when does this all get done and paid for then, Tom, this year?
So we'll be looking at putting this into place this year. By December, we want to have by January, we want to have the front entrance ways all redesigned and built in and put in place. Fencing will happen as we are able to. Depends on how late we get into the construction season, because we'll have to put some footings down for the fences and things like that.
So, but the office work can be done, the front office?
So we're looking at the
school?
Looking at the four elementary schools. We think we can get that put together and in place by the end of the year.
Okay. Let's see. Moving on to the strategic planning discussion, you have scheduled, I guess, sessions to start talking about these. Are these going to be regularly scheduled board meetings or...
This is going to be separate. We are going to get updates at the board level, but we're also going to be doing a lot of community outreach. Our first event is October 2nd, which will be at the Blair Education Center at the hospital. It is from 6 to 8 p.m. and will be moderated by the professors at the University of Utah who are managing the process. So it's not going to be, you know, Todd and I standing up there moderating a session. It's really a listening exercise and a session for people to kind of voice their opinions. And that will be the first of several.
So will you have to notice the meetings? Because you'll probably want to hear what people
say. We'll notice it because I would imagine that all of us will be there in terms of the school board members. But we're going to be starting a social media campaign as well this week. Melinda, who's our new communications director, will be on that and trying to get as many people as possible. Obviously, the venue is large enough where we can hold quite a few folks.
Yeah, and what's the objective of that first meeting? Just an overview, or
it's really just to hear to get community input. That's what we need to do at this point is listen to what the community's priorities are and try to collate those and move forward.
So how long before we have a plan completed?
We're looking at early next year, I believe, is the timeline on that.
Yeah, so the strategic planning and all of those conversations go with that. We're hoping to have done actually by about March or April of next year.
Okay, because there was some talk about, do we do this one thing at a time, or do we just try and do everything together? Is that the way we're going? Just do everything at once so that we can, if in fact, get a bond put on November's ballot of 18? That you'd be ready to do that?
I think we're gonna have to see how the process goes, to be honest. I would be hopeful that we can get get a bond on the ballot, but again, it's going to depend on how much consensus, if any, we can get from the community around what the building should look like and what the grade alignment should look like. As a board, we're listening. We're not going into this with any preconceived notions that we're definitely doing anything at any point. We want the community to be heard. We want there to be complete buy-in. We know that the community recognizes there needs to be new facilities, but we also know that the community is very opinionated on that. The only thing I would say is at the same time, we are looking at options on land, and we're working very diligently. Todd is leading that charge, but we're looking at options so that we're not so that we have different options to offer the community about where to put schools, what they could look like, et cetera.
That's a really big change from a couple of years ago when it was like full steam ahead.
Yeah, I mean, look, we it's undeniable we have the facility needs. I think the difference is that we, the community owns the schools. The school board doesn't own the schools. And we have heard loud and clear from the community that they want to be listened to, that they want input, that these are their schools and their facilities. And we agree. It's our job to make sure we push forward and that we have safe buildings for our students to learn in. But, we're also being realistic that we're asking for a massive amount of money to build these facilities. And that's going to take, consensus buy-in from the community. And that's what we're working towards. And it just takes time.
How many of these strategic planning meetings will be scheduled?
I don't know the exact number. I think it's, I think it will probably depend on how well it's attended or not. Unfortunately, when we have these town halls and community meetings, sometimes they're not very well attended, which is a shame because it's an opportunity. But we also understand that, people's schedules are very busy in this town. And so we'll probably host a couple of them so that we make sure we can get as many people as possible. And again, as I always say, please reach out to your school board member if you have opinions, views, or directly to Ember or the administration. We want to hear from you.
All right, let's turn to district enrollment. I guess this is your bailiwick here, Todd. How are class sizes looking initially? I mean, we looked like the kindergarten projections were a little bit higher in some of the schools.
Yeah, so those are higher, and then some of the other grades are lower. The August physical counts that we do are just the first data point in an exercise of trying to understand enrollment for the year. So I don't put a lot of credit onto the August counts and say, oh, this is the number. That's not where we're going to be. We use that. We'll do another count this Friday, and those two will then inform internal decisions on whether we have to adjust classes. Do we need to hire more teachers? Do we need to consolidate classes, et cetera? So we're just at the front edge of gathering that information.
What's your instinct, though, tell you that we're okay? We're
my instinct will really kick in after Friday's numbers come in, because once I have those two, I'll have a pretty good idea of where enrollment's headed.
Yeah. Any idea how many parents are opting out of the full-day kindergarten, or do we have 100% participation there?
I don't know that. Oh. I'd have to take a look and see.
Yeah, because, it's open to anybody who wants it.
It is, correct.
Yeah. Okay.
It's been a pretty successful program, and, I think the increased class sizes, show you that people are happy with it. I mean, my own daughter went through it last year, and we were thrilled with how it went. And I think it's overdue, that we have the ability to teach our kids from a very early age in our schools.
There was also some discussion yesterday about open enrollment. Andrew, you were suggesting that the school district could consider closing schools to outside school districts. But again, there's that state law. And you're thinking, well, has anybody challenged that state law?
Yeah, I mean, look, it's a touchy subject. Obviously, we need to follow state law, and we're going to be reviewing our policy with regards to class sizes and with regards to how much space we have in our schools. I mean, as we've talked about before, we're a unique district in that we have a lot of extra programs, and we also choose as a community to have smaller class sizes. And so our capacity is different than, say, other schools around the state, and we need to recognize that and make sure that we're not you know, artificially keeping things open when we look around and we have trailers at most of our schools. I think it's a difficult sell to our community to have our schools open. And we're going to be working on that diligently over the next few weeks to see if there's a way to close those.
Yeah, I don't think that state law cares how many kids are in a classroom, though, does it?
No, it's about teachable square footage.
Yep.
And so, you know, we're going to be, again, we're going to be working on it. And, you know, Todd and I will be looking at it along with policy committee to try to see if there's a way that we can, you know, that we can close them. I mean, our schools are, they're at capacity as far as we're concerned. And so, you know, the state law is that they want all schools to remain open. There's always the opportunity for people to challenge us. But I think, you know, as a district, it's time for us to, you know, and again, this is my opinion only as one vote. But I think it's time for us to say enough is enough and you know, recognize that we're full.
Yeah. Todd, do the numbers of out-of-district students, are they making a difference on our classes?
So on the class sizes, generally speaking, no. We did the analysis last year when we had this conversation about open enrollment. And when you look at how the students are spread across the schools and the grade levels, it's a two or three here, two or three there. When you add that up across the whole system, it adds up to over 150, maybe 170 students in total. But when you have just a couple here and there, it really doesn't change dynamics of classroom sizes or the teaching ratios that we have.
Okay. So what good does it do to close classrooms? I mean, if we're talking about, I mean, it's not them, it's us within the district where the numbers are coming from. Yeah?
Sure. Well, I think Member Butler brought up that, well, if there's only two students in a class and we have 21 students in the class, we want to get it below 20, that's two less. And so we're closer to the standards that we want to have for our classrooms. So that sentiment's out there that, you know, you could actually have a smaller class without those out-of-boundary students in there. And then there's others that worry about the finances, that the taxpayers here are contributing to the education system, but it should go to our students, not necessarily to students from out-of-boundary.
All right. Let's turn to homework policy. Jeremy Ranch piloting a reading-only homework policy. What's the current research that would support this, Andrew?
Yeah, so there's a ton of it, actually. A lot of it is on board docs, for those of you who care. You know, it's linked to on our website, and you can review it. And if you have more requests, Sean Keenan or Dr. Einhorn are happy to discuss more. But the premise is that, especially for our younger students, having more time to get out and play, having more time to sit at the table and eat dinner with their family, makes less anxiety, makes the school day a lot more approachable and more enjoyable. And, you know, Dr. Einhorn last night compared it to asking our littlest kids to do a double shift, right? We ask them to be in school and learn for 7 hours a day, and then we expect them to come home and do several hours of homework a day. And when you have kids who take very different amounts of time to do the same assignment, you could have one assignment that a child could do in 10 minutes, and it could take another child an hour to do that same assignment. It's very difficult to set a daily time frame for how much homework we're giving our students. And it causes a lot of anxiety. We find that kids are trying to cram their work in either on the bus home or on the bus on the way to school in the morning. You know, we found in our after school programs that an hour was being put towards completing homework assignments and only 15 minutes was being put towards science enrichment. And we want to flip that around, right? We want kids to be excited to be in school when they're there, to be focusing when they're there. And then when they're home, I mean, we're talking about 6-, 7-, 8-year-old children who, you know, can be able to go out and have some fun. And Dr. Einhorn also cited a study where looking at, you know, the top performing nations in terms of education and how much time they were spending every day doing homework. And the U.S. is about double what the top performing nations are in terms of homework assignments. So there's a lot of research out there. We're fortunate in that we're piloting it at one school, and we're going to see how it goes throughout the year and how it affects both academic results as well as emotional results and kids' anxiety. And then we'll make an assessment as we move on.
Yeah. But I mean, I remember spending not a whole lot of time, but going through the spelling words, right? Going through your multiplication tables. So that's all off the table now. Yeah.
Well, the encouragement is to read every day. And what we're asking our students to do is to read for 20 to 30 minutes every day and use that time to learn and use the time in the classroom to go over multiplication and spelling and to make reading fun again, to have some time to pursue other activities. We know in our community kids are very busy doing all kinds of things. And so we want to, you know, we want well-rounded children. And this is a pilot to test that and to see how that goes.
Any pushback from parents thinking that maybe their kids are going to get left behind?
We've received some. I actually asked that question of Sean last night, the principal at Jeremy, and he said of the feedback he's gotten, about 90% is positive and 10% is pushback. And we'll continue to monitor that. Obviously, we don't want to upset parents. We don't want to have a subpar academic offering. That's not our intention at all. Our intention is to have academic excellence, but also a healthy environment for our children. And we're going to be watching it very closely.
All right. Andrew or Todd, anything else you wanted to add?
No, just a reminder, October 2nd at the hospital, the Blair Education Center is our first exercise in master planning. Please come if you can. It's from 6 to 8 p.m. If you can't make it and you have some thoughts, I'm sure we're going to be putting out some recaps in terms of the meeting, but please get in touch with your school board rep or the administration directly, and we'll try to fill you in.
Okay, Andrew Kaplan and Todd Halber, thanks for your time this morning.
Thanks, Leslie.
Welcome.
It's 8:33. Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. It's the local news hour on KPCW. Well, after 21 years as editor of the Park Record, Nanchalot Noker has announced that she'll be retiring as of October 6th. For a look at a journalism career that spans nearly 40 years here in Park City, Nan joins me now in the studio. Good morning and congratulations.
Good morning, Les.
So you could keep doing this. Why the decision to say you're done?
I wanted, honestly, to go out on a high note while people still kind of like me and while I'm still enjoying it. And it's not to say I've had some pangs over the last couple of weeks as we start actually talking about leaving.
Yeah. So what's the plan for you in the future?
You know, my schedule is full until October 6th, and then it's blue sky. So I'm excited about learning more about multimedia and getting more involved in some other pet projects.
Yeah. So you got your first byline in what used to be known as the Park Records Only Competition, the newspaper. That was back in 1977. Do you remember what that story was?
You know, I think it was a review of a show at the Kimball Arts Center.
Okay. And you went to Brown University for psychology. So how did you find yourself in journalism?
I come from a family of readers and book lovers and politically active people, and I think it was in my DNA at some point.
Yeah. And how did you find yourself in Park City?
I had a friend who I went to high school with. She went to Wellesley and I went to Brown. We were friendly during college. She came out to Utah. She followed a guy out here. I think she was in love with someone who moved to Park City. And I came out to, she was having so much fun. I came out to see her, came out in the back of her van and hitchhiked to Salt Lake to go buy my first car and begged for a job at the newspaper and was lucky enough to start working there.
Yeah. So you also had a stint here at KPCW as news director for 5 years. That was when the radio station did its merger with Park City Television. So, I mean, you've really kind of had your foot in all of it, huh, at some point.
Dan Wilcox was the wonderful morning anchor at the time, and Bill Coleman and Blair Fulner cooked up a plan to start a little cable TV station. And I had to go learn how to apply makeup, actually, to be on TV. And it was terrifying.
And it didn't really last long. So I guess everyone was, you and Rick, were
that
kind of
TV station,
for that.
I think, became Park City TV, Channel 45, eventually under new ownership. And KPCW continued to get stronger and stronger on its own.
Yeah. So, again, you used to be doing what I'm doing now. People could hear you
not
on the radio.
Not as well, Les. No. You know how much I respect your work.
But I remember one of the cutest stories. There were a couple of twins in town that they would hear your broadcast. And after, you know, you'd say, and I'm Nan Shalott, they would say, thanks a lot, Nan Shalott.
Yes.
Anyway, I remember you passing me a note in the city council meeting. That was at the point where I was working for the TV station. And you said that you were leaving radio to pursue your love of photography. So that was what, just needed to do something else?
For about 3 years, I ran a portrait photography business. But throughout that time, I was also doing freelance writing for Salt Lake Magazine. I think it was Utah Holiday at the time. And High Country News. I had a couple pieces in that newspaper.
So that's what you may think about doing in the future then, just some of that kind of freelance writing.
Definitely want to continue butting into people's lives and indulging in my curious nature.
Well, let's talk about some of the stories you've covered. I mean, we're talking about a 40-year span here of reporting Park
it
City,
sounds like
Summit
forever.
County. It does. Well, I mean, do you have any favorite stories as opposed to kind of challenging stories?
Oh, perhaps favorite would be being part of our Olympic coverage, because it was so uplifting after having been through 9/11. The town really came together. It just sparkled with enthusiasm and warmth, and we had sort of love coming from all over the world after 9/11, and the volunteers and the athletes, and it was a magical time, I think.
Yeah. And we've certainly have had, I mean, I guess we're lucky in that sense that we really get to report mostly good news in this town, but we've certainly had some really horrifying incidents as well. You know, a couple of murders, you know, with the singers, you know, with Natalie Noble, with Patty Blanchard. So that's really brings it home, I guess. And really
some
difficult when you know these people so well.
Some of the tough stories, there are people in town now who don't remember the Singer siege. And there was a polygamist who lived on the east side of the county who defied law enforcement, decided not to send his kids to school. He was a polygamist. And someone drew a line in the sand and said, you have to or we'll arrest you. He was shot when they tried to arrest him. 10 years later, a fundamentalist group became involved with that family and wanted to avenge his death, blew up a church or bombed a church on the east side of the county. And it was, you know, it was our little Waco with all in Ruby Ridge. It was all those issues about law enforcement and how to handle, you know, a disruptive group in the most humane way possible. And it was because I knew the family that was holed up and under federal siege, I had mixed feelings about both sides and who was right and the best way to handle it.
Yeah. So what's the hardest part of being a newspaper editor?
Boy, I just visited with a friend who was an editor for the newspaper in the late 1970s. She said it was the hardest job she has ever had, and that was 40 years ago. So I think that it is, for me, it's been constantly trying to make sure that we reflect the community, not me or a particular individual, but to try and figure out what the community wants, what's best for the community. And I've had a wonderful publisher to work with who our goals are the same. And Andy Bernhard gave me the job of the opportunity of my life, I'd say. And he comes at it sometimes as a publisher must from a different perspective. And I have to say that we've always been able to come to an agreement, even if we're possibly offending an advertiser. He's always taken the side of journalism.
Yeah. So you've had lots of owners, though, in the same time, but one publisher, huh?
In the time that I've been editor, yes.
Yeah, it's like, what, two or three, four owners? I don't know. I can't even keep track of them.
Dean Singleton, wonderful, ferocious, passionate journalist. And Media News Group, Digital First Media, and currently Swift Communications. And that was another reason that I felt it was an appropriate time to make a new step, because Swift has brought so many new resources to the table for us. It's a very positive time for the paper. Andy and I went through the recession and some really fragile times for the paper, and right now it's really strong.
Yeah, and back to that kind of really hard part about being an editor, and I guess it's just thick skin, or you just have to kind of move on. But, you know, when you and editorials come out against things like school bonds or favor one candidate over another, you hear about it?
Or I do not have a thick skin, even after all these years. And yes, it's you really being an editor in a small town, I've always told the reporters, is such a cauldron for accountability and good journalism, because you cannot avoid the people that you've written about. And so you have to be willing to stand behind, you know, think carefully about what you're writing, and then stand by it, be willing to stand by it. So there have been a few encounters that have been uncomfortable.
Yeah. And what about having to come up with two editorials a week? Is that always a challenge? I mean, you think about it, it's a small town. Is there not much to say something about?
We have three kinds of editorials. I'm not sure. This is like revealing maybe our secrets, my secret. There's the Go Big Red editorial, and that is congratulating people for a job well done. And certainly we've had tons of opportunities to do that when we purchased big swaths of open space and people do other courageous things. Go Big Red. And then there is Proceed with Caution. That's make sure you're paying attention to what's going on up at City Hall, what's going on in the world. And then there's Throw the Bums Out. And to be honest, we probably have not done that many of those. The state legislature gives me a chance to get out my punching bag a little bit. But otherwise, things are usually pretty positive.
Yeah, let's talk briefly about some of just the amazing technological changes. I mean, as you remember, working here at the radio station, we used to have to cut tape with a razor blade.
Now yes,
it's all done all digitally now. Same thing, though, with the newspaper. I mean, you used to be on the newspaper offices on Main Street and in a small dark room.
I wish that I had taken more photos of Rick Bruff spotting out the page negatives or pasting up just little line corrections. We really did everything by hand for a long, long time. Personally, I have found the technology to be a thrilling aspect of staying with the paper this long. I was there when we first went onto the World Wide Web, and I've just found it fascinating.
Yeah, but certainly, I mean, we've got the competition, right? And we've got the Twitters and the Facebooks and the Instagram and all of that, where we've got the citizen journalists out there reporting, which not necessarily is true or fair or accurate, you know, what we strive for as journalists, but yet it's competition.
There are so many demands for people's attention right now, and it's just a privilege that, to me, that people still consider the newspaper, you know, one of their trusted sources. And Park City is fortunate to have the newspaper, the Park Record, and KPCW. And I think that people do turn to us, you and the paper, for the straight scoop.
Yeah. I'm going to ask, because people have asked, you know, why not Jay Hamburger? They've named a successor, Bubba Brown, who's been a longtime reporter with you. But Jay seemed like he was next in line.
You know, the first person I told about my decision to leave was my publisher. And we were kind of keeping it a little bit quiet while we determined a strategy to find a successor. But the second person I told was Jay Hamburger. And I asked him to seriously consider. We just celebrated his 20th year at the Park Record. And I asked him to consider the position, gave him a job description. And Jay decided that he adores what he does. He is, the shoe leather that he has worn out walking up and down Main Street and back and forth to Planning Commission meetings and City Council meetings cannot be replicated by anyone else. And he decided that's what he wanted to do. He didn't apply.
Okay. Well, let's talk a little bit about your successor, Bubba Brown. Again, he has been reporting business and school board issues.
For 3 years. He, he's got tattoos and great big biceps, and sometimes he's sporting a buzz cut. He has a huge, huge heart. And he has shown in covering both the business beat and the education beat that he understands our community and our values, and he's well respected in both of those circles. So I think he's going to do a super job. He's so excited, and he and his wife, Alyssa, are moving up from Salt Lake so that he can really be more accessible here in Park City.
Any advice for Bubba?
I've talked to him, and I think overarching advice to, we've got some new reporters too, is try to say yes whenever people ask you if the paper can do something, and keep an open mind and an open heart.
Okay. Well, congratulations on your retirement. You've got another month to go, so enjoy it.
And you and I will still talk about all the issues.
Yeah. Okay. It's Nan Shalott Melker, again, the editor of the Park Record through October. 8:51 now. Good morning. Well, on display now in both the main gallery and the cafe gallery at the Kimball Arts Center are the works of Utah artist Jimmy Toro, who joins me now in the studio. Good morning, Jimmy.
Hi. How are you?
I'm well, thanks. So tell us a little bit about yourself.
Grew up in California, moved a few places, ended up here in Utah for the last maybe 4 or 5 years. I've been doing the art thing forever. It's one of those kids who drew instead of did homework.
All right. Well,
and, ended up sitting in front of you talking about it.
Yeah. So we'll talk to us a little bit about your artwork. I mean, what is it that you do?
Primarily right now I do oil paintings. Primary subject is anatomy. This show at the Kimball is all about faces.
Okay. And the title of the show is Kindle a Light. So how do the pieces that you have up kind of describe that?
Well, that quote is carried forward is about creating something with a purpose, something that has meaning to it, not just a painting, just to paint. And so all the paintings there have a purpose and a meaning and a direction. They're all based around music and music lyrics, kind of an interplay or interpretation between music, lyrics, and painting.
Okay. And the exhibit's up now through when?
Till the end of November. I don't know what date, like 20th, 26th, or somewhere in there.
Okay. So we've got some kind of opportunity drawing. Do you know about this?
Opportunity drawing?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, yeah, there's a painting there that a gentleman, Mick Savage, purchased from me years ago, and he donated it back to the Kimball for a drawing.
Okay, yeah. And so people, this is a way to support the art center then.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
All right, so can you tell us about the painting that people could win?
Well, it falls in line with all the other ones. It's a painting of a face, and it's about, I think it's like 36 inches by 32 inches, so medium size, original.
Okay. You also, it looks like, you do a lot of faces. I mean, that's kind of your work, or do you do landscapes as well, or just?
No, over the years I've tried pretty much everything in every medium, but I love anatomy and particularly faces. There's an identity you can, an emotion you can get out of a face that you can't necessarily out of a body or a hand or a foot,
yeah,
et cetera.
Are you, I mean, are they based on photographs of people or are they just out of your imagination?
All the above, yeah. I've done a lot of portraits, so yeah, everything. I paint a lot, so I have a lot of opportunities.
Yeah. How is it that you get an exhibit at the Kimball? I mean, do they approach you or do you just kind of submit stuff to the galleries and ask them to consider?
I'm not sure their official protocol to do that. I've known the director, Robin, for years, and I've won Best of Show at the Kimball Art Center several times. And over the course of several years, it's just been talked about and put on the calendar and finally got it. So it's great.
Well, good. Congratulations. So
how many
pieces you got hanging?
I believe there are probably around 30, 35, somewhere in there.
Okay. And all for sale?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
And I noticed it's November 26th is the...
26th, there you go, end of November.
Stays up. Okay, well, good luck, and hey, thanks for spending some time with us this morning.
Yes, no problem, thank you.
That's Utah artist Jimmy Toro again. His work on display now in both the main gallery and the cafe gallery at the Kimball Art Center through November 26th. You're listening to the Local News Hour here on KPCW.